The Chancellor moves slowly, faking a limp as she steps off the ramp of the Ganoidian cruiser. She waves to those gathered. It seems their time trapped in space caused a bit of a stir, a little drama, and now Nakadians have gathered to watch it end. Cams hover nearby, broadcasting. She spies a familiar face at the margins, Tracine Kane of Holonet News. As she hobbles forward, Wartol steps next to her. He's smiling, waving at the crowd, but his low-spoken words to her betray any mirth he broadcasts on his face.
Quit limping.
I seem to have injured my ankle a touch. I'll get along.
Another ploy.
Hardly, she lies. My good friend Akbar has had me on a rather strict exercise regimen ever since the attack left me in critical care, and I fear I've overexerted myself just a touch. How does the saying go? Slow and steady wins the race?
She emphasizes those last three words. Wins the race.
It shows how pathetic you are that you're resorting to cheap stunts such as this one. It only delays the inevitable, Chancellor.
He nods at a nearby cam in an avuncular way before returning to hiss in her ear.
You'll still lose. You'll lose everything. No ruse of yours will stop that.
Over their heads roared the engines of a familiar freighter, the Millennium Falcon. Hope is a small ember, but with the sight of that, it burns brighter. Mon prays they have found something, anything to give her an edge. Two streets over from the Senate House sits an agricultural warehouse with a red roof. Behind it are docking platforms meant for harvesters and agri-droids, but one of them is occupied with a different ship, Dor Waido's Tyrusian sky sloop. That's it. Sinjir knows it. He has to hope they're not too late. They have little time to discuss a plan. What they know is this. Summoning the Senate Guard or the Nakadian peace officers won't work. The common problem? No time. They think to intercept the four other bribed and blackmailed senators inside the Senate House, but that too is an impossible task. Security there will be tight, and trying to bust in with guns blazing will only get them shot. They could attempt to stop the vote, but the vote needs to happen. If any of this comes to light, the result will almost certainly be a vote delayed by an investigation, which could take weeks to resolve. Weeks when Jazz and Nora are left on an Imperial-occupied world. And those plans also leave Condor on the hook. That leaves them with one avenue of action, and not a lot of time to plan out their assault. Solo finds no safe place to put the Falcon. No nearby docking bay, no hangar, no platform. He grins then. That scandalous boomerang grin.
I have a plan,
he says. Do it, Sinjir says, without even asking what it is. They pull him out of the academy. He is hand-selected by a brutal, brick-faced woman named Officer Sid Udra. Udra tells Sinjir Rath Velis that he will be no trooper. He is too angry, and he is too smart. Both qualities that make for a poor soldier.
They are just fodder, anyway, she says as an aside, dismissing an entire army with a sour sneer.
He ends up in a new training program, this one located in a boxy Duracrete building. This severe structure is the Viper's Nest, and it sits on a peak surrounded by the roiling oceans of Virkoi. It is where the Imperial Security Bureau trains its LOs, the loyalty officers. Udra tells him that she comes from the same system as he, Volusia. He is from Seven Moon, she from Six Moon.
You are like me, she tells him. You get along with no one. They don't like you, and you don't like them. It matters little where it started. Over time, you've learned to protect yourself by preemptively hating everyone else. You distrust and despise even me. Good. That hate will save you. More important, that hate will save the Empire.
And she explains to him what his role will be in the Empire from now on. He will train to become Loyalty Officer Rathvelis. He will hide in plain sight. He will use that hatred of others to see in them their weakness. Every weak Imperial is a fontanelle where the skin goes thin and the Empire becomes vulnerable. Then she tells him his training begins now. She beats him. He is young and foolish and thinks he can fight back against this small, hard stump of a woman. He is wrong. Udra's movements are short and precise. He swings, she ducks. He leaps, she sidesteps. Every time he misses, she lands a hit. To his ribs, to the side of his neck, to his kidneys. Soon he is left panting and sobbing on the floor, on his hands and knees. Udra goes to work on him, whipping him with a wet towel rolled up, bending his fingers back. Not so they break, but so the pain forces him to confess everything about himself, inserting small slivers of metal under his fingernails. The pain is intense. It is clarifying. It rips him open, and everything that he is spills out of his blubbering mouth. This happens again and again. Sinjir trains during the day. He suffers at night. Udra never shows emotion. She studies him, like an eight-legger deciding which part of the fly to eat first. Udra dissects him. He is unlike her. He is not cold and calculating. He is angry, vicious, full of rage. Udra explains,
I will burn that out of you until all that's left is charred and black. A hot coal gone cold.
Then she breaks his toes. Then one day, it is his turn. Not to fight her, no, but to turn what he has learned, what has been visited upon him, against another. She shows him a door. In this door is a window, and through that window, he sees a man in a black officer's uniform. Bars on the fellow's chest indicate that this man with pinched eyes and a pug's nose is a lieutenant serving the Imperial Navy. Udra tells Sinjir,
He will be your first.
She explains why the man is here.
We believe he is part of a cabal of conspirators who seek to unseat Palpatine from the throne by committing to an assassination plot against the Emperor's enforcer, Darth Vader. You will root out the names of the other conspirators. Before you do, however, there is one last lesson.
She takes him outside, where a storm rages. On Vir Khoi, a storm always rages. Udra takes a blaster rifle from a rack against the wall of the Viper's Nest, and she points it off at the black, storm-crushed horizon. Udra fires. The bolt cuts through the rain and the winds. It moves fast, a bright flash lancing the dark until it's a pinprick, then gone.
You must be like that,
she hisses in his ear.
You are that bolt of searing plasma. You will always be unswerving, no matter the rain or the wind, no matter how hot or how cold, through the air, through the void. You must be the brightest beam of light. Only then will the truth be out.
Sinjir understands. He pushes his anger away. He tortures Lieutenant Alster Grove for 2 nights straight, until the man yields the names of his fellow conspirators. Udra dumps Grove screaming into the churning sea. The other conspirators are hunted down by Vader and beheaded.
I am the brightest beam of light.
All else is chaos. It is like the wind-whipped sea of Virkoi. He will not be fazed by it. He must not be fazed by it. Solo uses the Falcon's belly turret to blow a hole in the top of the warehouse roof. Then he sets the Falcon right down upon it. Tenon stays behind to watch Rethalo. The rest of them are off. Sinjir is first through the breach. The warehouse is dim. The noise has already drawn foes. They come up on him in what seems like slow motion. I am the brightest beam of light. A thick-skulled Nikto swings a saw-toothed axe at his head. He deftly dips away from the blade, then twists the thug's arm back, 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 until there's the dull, vegetal crunch of tendons ripping. Sinjir pitches the Nikto behind him, just as a plasma bolt snaps through the air, taking the thug out. That from Jom, coming up behind. He's yelling something to Sinjir, something about keep going, keep moving. I'll cover you. But the ex-Imperial barely registers it at all. I am the brightest beam of light. Two more Nikto thugs come up between shelf stacks of motivator parts. Two more bolts of light through dark space. One from Han, the other from Jom. Both foes find their heels skidding out from under them as they are taken down, one after the other. Sinjir stalks the half-dark. He draws his own blaster. Some bent-necked Ithorian comes charging up, but Sinjir's arm is already up. His finger is already tightening. The Ithorian goes from two eyes to three as a searing hole opens in the center of his head. I am the brightest beam of light. The storm of violence roils. A shelf crashes down against another. Jom is on the floor, tackled by a smashed-faced Iotran. The two wrestle against his rifle, thrashing about. Ahead, Solo runs and guns, ducking and darting, his blaster spitting plasma. Bright spears of red crisscross in front of Sinjir, carving scorching lines in his vision. Motion comes from his right. Sinjir does not even pause to regard it. His movement is automatic, driving the butt end of his rifle hard to that side. It crashes into the throat of some one-eyed pirate with a little head and a big gut. The man yowls and gargles past his own crushed trachea. Sinjir shoots him in the chest, then kicks him away before continuing through the warehouse space. I am the brightest beam of light. And that light now shines on Condor Kyle. Everything focuses on that point. Condor, at the far end of the warehouse, kneeling on the floor, his head down, hands bound behind him. Beyond him, another figure. A child in a metal cage. A child with a bobbling, wobbling head atop a white stalk neck. Nimtar's child. Abducted and kept close. No sign of the Jerba. But Sinjir can't give one hot damn about that. Truth be told, he cares nothing for the child either. The only one he cares about is Condor. A massive Herglick stands by the slicer, rubbery mitt grabbing the back of Condor's head. The monster wrenches his head backward. And now Sinjir can see Condor's bruised, nose-broken face. The Herglick's massive maw opens and roars a threat.
Come closer and I'll break his neck!
And Sinjir knows the beast can do it. Will do it. But only if Sinjir is slow. And Sinjir is very fast.
I am the brightest beam of light!
Even as the brute finishes his threat, Sinjir is already firing his blaster. The blaster was never his specialty. Udra told him,
"You are the weapon. No blaster will ever do the damage you can do when you're up close."
But he isn't close. Not now. And this is the only tool he has. He has to shoot true. He has to come correct. The plasma bolt spears the air. The Herglick tightens his grip. "Don't you hurt him. Don't you dare hurt him." Condor cries out, his eyes going wide. No, no, no! The plasma bolt punches through the Hurglick's roaring mouth and out the back of his head. The Hurglick moans, the bleating cry of a dying Iowa, and drops backward like a stack of crates. Condor topples over to the side, unmoving.
I am the brightest beam of light.
Brightest, yes. But was he the fastest? The blaster rifle clatters. Sinjir's footsteps echo in time with his own pounding heart. He drops to his knees, sliding forward to scoop Condor up, cradling him. The slicer's head flops lifelessly to the side. And Sinjir feels his eyes burning hot tears.
I wasn't the fastest. I was too slow.
Then, Condor's one eye wrenches open. He gasps. Sinjir gasps with him.
Condor, you're okay. Tell me you're okay. Tell me you're okay.
He's used to pulling information out of people one fingernail at a time. Now he just wants the most basic data.
Are you okay, Condor? Are you okay?
Took you long enough,
Condor says, woozily smiling. Sinjir stoops and kisses him. His long-fingered hands pull the other man's scruffy face into his own. The moment lasts forever. And it still doesn't last long enough, because now here's Han, and he's got a hand on Sinjir's shoulder.
We're not done yet, remember?
Sinjir remembers. He stares deep into Condor's eyes.
I'm going to get you free. I know you're hurt, but we need your help. Can you slice?
With you by my side, I can do anything.
Chapter 24.
The Nakadian chamber house isn't like the one on Chandrilla. The Chandrillan chamber had an epic sweep to it, with endless scalloped balconies atop endless balconies, as far as the eyes could see. The one here on Nakadia is smaller, more humble. It's wood, not stone. Simple chairs in wooden boxes. Nothing is sculpted, nothing ornate. The seats are not merely before her, but all around her, and what feels like a whirling cyclone of faces looking down upon her. Judging her, she suspects. The speech Mon Mothma gives ahead of the vote is essentially the same as she gave back on Chandrilla a week before. But it is shorter, and it is angrier. The anger is real, because she fears that no matter what she says, it won't matter. She fears she is screaming into a void.
We have to vote yes. We have to end the Empire. We mustn't be hesitant. Not now. Not so close to its conclusion.
And she adds in one last barb, a line she knows she will one day regret, because it does not sound like her. The threat, the bluster, the venom. But she says it anyway.
Those who vote no, recognize that you are marked. You will be marked as cowards at best, and traitors at worst.
She does not like the way she sounds, even though she knows the words are sincere.
I sound like a dictator.
She sounds like Palpatine. The Chancellor leaves the circular stage by going down a set of spiraling steps. At the bottom, she nearly collapses against the railing. She's so tired, so bone-weary.
After righting herself, she ends up in the small office afforded to her. An office underground, whose window is literally pressed up against the soil. In the rich tilth, she sees the lightning shape of forked roots and the turning tunnels of crawling worms. Oxy enters after.
That was a great speech,
she says.
I pushed too hard at the end. I went too far. Maybe they'll respect someone who goes that far.
She tells Oxy that she needs to be alone for a while. After Oxy leaves, Mon spends time trying to flex the hand at the end of her injured arm. The fingers have the strength of moth wings. She spies a stain at the end of her sleeve. A bit of pitta juice from the fruit. Mon sits like that for a while, staring down, flexing her weak fingers. hunching over farther and farther, until she feels like a monk, so reverent and so worshipful, that she'll fold in on herself and become one with the living force. The air changes. Someone is here. She looks up, embarrassed, a blushing bloom rising to her normally pale cheeks. There stands Oxy, her face dark. The vote failed again. She can see it.
Now what?
Bond says weakly, desperately.
We finish the war,
Oxy answers.
What? The vote passed, Mon. The vote passed.
Part 4. Interlude. Deveron.
In the deep shadows of a moonless night, deeper shadows gather. Beyond them wait the low slopes of the Karatoke Mountains. Ahead of them is a narrow valley in which there sits an outpost that has changed hands many times over the centuries. Once a Republic outpost, it fell to the Empire when Imperial reign ruled over Deveron. And now, yet again, it has returned to the hands of the revivified Republic. Here the jungle is noisy. Flocks of gold-feathered Takatae roost in the vine tangle above, chirruping and cack-cack-cacking. A thousand different insects hum and chatter in a cacophonous choir. Something kilometers away bellows, calling to another of its kind in the opposite direction. But the shadows remain silent and still. They are patient. They are waiting. Down in the valley, the outpost is lit by bold beams from spotlights. Beams that capture the slippery, sliding night mists. A flurry of activity sees ships landing and unloading supplies. The New Republic is establishing outposts new and old across the planet's surface. They bring people. They bring food and potable water. They have diplomats, liaisons, scientists, and of course, soldiers. They are invaders. This is a sacred place. 100 clicks from here is an old Jedi temple. It is not the only place on this planet strong in the Force. The shadows cannot feel this themselves, for they are not conduits for the Force, but merely slaves to it, as are all living things. All are caught in the river of the power that is the Force, trapped by its currents. Only those who wield the dark side of the Force are capable of changing those currents. They are river breakers. They do not surrender to fate. They are its foes. The shadows are acolytes of the beyond. Here wait 2 dozen of them, though they are only one cell among many across the galaxy. Though they grow restive, they know to wait. They mustn't disappoint their masters. Kaisa, a young Pantoran woman from Coronet City on Corellia, faces a wave of sudden doubt. She stands among people who are not her friends, not exactly, but who are her cohorts. Yiz, Lalu, Corbus, and her fellow Corellian, a friend and sometimes lover, Remy. She's not at all like Remy, though she pretends to be. He, like her, like all of them, has had the dreams. He's received the visions of the darkness. Dreams of Sith, both ancient and recently living, plaguing his nights. And he loves it. He loves being a part of something. The darkness hasn't taken him. He has given himself to it. Kaisa pretends to be the same, but she's not so sure. She's angry, that much she knows. As a street rat in the worst parts of Coronet City, she has a lot of rage divvied up among an unholy host of those who have made her life harder. The peace officers that hassled her, the chits and debits office that chased her for every last debt against her family's accounts, the high-born Corellians who would stare down their noses at a low-born gutter girl like her. When the dream started, and when the man came to recruit her, the acolytes seemed an easy fit. She had anger to spare, and she was told that her anger was purifying. It was a virtue, the man told her, a necessary vice. It was anger that shaped the galaxy. It was rage that fueled the engines of change. It made sense. It felt like home. She started low in the order, as they all did. She tagged walls with the Vader mask sigil and the warning, "Vader lives." She stole credits and tithed them to the cause. While others were slicing into the holonet or attacking security forces, she was still scouting locations for dead drops or safe meets. Then came Remy. He had this perfect mix of confidence and injury, like a monster who had been tamed, a fire whose flame was both brutal and beautiful. He was young. He was angry. He was gorgeous. That's when he told her what they needed her to do next. She would get a job inside the P&S station. Kaiser would work with the peace officers. They had rigged up new papers for her, new thumbprint scans, a new digital history. Gone was Kaiser the street rat. Here was Kaiser the doll, with good breeding, the dame from the secretary pool. Then came the night when the acolytes attacked the city. A distraction so she and Remy could steal something from the archives underneath the station. A relic from a fallen Sith. A lightsaber. That lightsaber now hangs at Remy's belt. Since that night, Remy has grown more egotistical. He ignites the blade sometimes and stares into it, his mouth moving as if he's whispering to it. Other lightsabers they've sacrificed to the Sith beyond. Those who have died and who wait beyond the veil, whose orders the acolytes follow. Those ancient specters are the ones who give them the dreams, after all. But now they've begun to keep the lightsabers. They have those and other artifacts, and only the most esteemed of the acolytes are allowed to hold, use, and keep them. Tonight, they move beyond the collection of relics. Tonight, they attack. Not just here. The strikes will take place across the galaxy. This is the first attack. And as such, it is a small one. In various systems, the acolytes have gathered on different worlds to slaughter enclaves and outposts of the New Republic. They do not have the number or the power to achieve bigger. Not yet. But they will. This is just the start. And Kaiser is afraid. She doesn't know if this is who she is. She doesn't know if she's as strong as Remy. She doesn't know if the visions she's experienced were even real. Kaiser thinks,
if I go ahead with it, if I go on this attack, I'll just stay in the background. I'll make it look like I'm doing something. Like I'm participating. Maybe I'll hit somebody or throw a detonator and blow up a shuttle.
The anger she's felt for so long curdles and goes sour. It turns to fear. Puzzlingly, it is that fear of which she is afraid. If she runs, if she seizes the fear and lets it guide her, they'll come for her. Remy won't let her escape. He'll find her tonight, or in a week, or in a year. Remy does not tolerate things that disappoint him. As she works diligently to still her heart, a new shadow joins them. This shadow, blacker than all the others. It is their master. It is Yup T'Shu. The acolytes bow to him. They gabble their glee at seeing him again after so long. He is not their only master. He is one of many, though their living masters number far fewer than their dead ones. but he is the closest they have to the Sith Empire created around Sidious and Vader. They paw at him, and he adores it, his crevice-lined face tilting back with pleasure. Kaisa does not join them. She's too afraid to do anything, even to move. It's as if she's a stack of little rocks, and if she moves, all of who she is will crumble apart and collapse. Tashu begins giving them their weapons. They were to wait for him here. He says they are special. They receive artifacts and relics from the ancient departed Sith. To some he hands dark robes. To others, he gives glowing red crystals around gut-leather cords. Then he turns to Kaisa. He hands her a mask. The mask is burnished bronze. The smooth metal is peppered with tiny hammered divots. The eyes are black glass. There is no nose or mouth, though where the mouth should be is a line of black rivets.
The mask of Viceroy Exim Panshard, he says, giggling. A mask made of meteoric metal and containing the screams of 100 innocents slaughtered for the Viceroy's pleasure. Masks have power. Some are worn in the grave, others worn in life. This, like the others in my collection, has gathered the darkness of the living force. Wear it. You are anointed Kaisa of Corellia.
The others stare at her, some in awe, others balefully. Remy's gaze is poisonous. He says suddenly,
I should have that!
And he reaches for the mask. Tashu snaps at him, literally. His mouth opens and closes on open air, the half-broken teeth clacking together as Remy's hand recoils.
You do not deny the wishes of the venerable specters, Tashu hisses. Also, the lady needs a weapon, does she not?
Tashu's eyes twinkle with a special kind of madness as he reaches down and snatches the lightsaber hilt from Remy's belt. He places it gingerly in her hand. It throbs with power. She knows not to turn it on. Not yet. Its red glow could give them away, but its potential thrums against her palm. And as she lifts her chin and lets the mask rest upon her face, she feels a wonderful darkness sweep over her. It is a consumptive void, and with great hunger, it chews into her fear and swallows it in great greedy gobbets. With the fear gone, her anger emerges anew. It springs forth like a living thing inside her. A vicious creature hatches within her heart. Time moves strangely. She blinks, and it has begun. She's there now, at the outpost.
I'm not alone,
she thinks. The others are here. They have their mundane weapons, clubs and machine shop blades, and ugly chop axes, all painted the red of blood, the red of Sith. Republic fools scream and flee. One comes toward her, and the red blade extends from its hilt in her hand. She can feel its vibration up through her elbow, all the way across the bridge of her shoulders, and into her very teeth. A swipe of the blade cuts one scream short. Another takes the legs out from under a fleeing woman. Hate pulses in her. Her heart beats so hard, it feels as if it'll shatter her breastbone in twain. Kaisa moves with little precision. She swings and swipes with the blade. The force does not move through her, but the weapon is still unlike anything else she's ever seen. It cuts through flesh, bone, metal. The light leaves streaks of itself burning across her vision. It thrills her. Then she's down. Something slams into her. Her head snaps against the ground.
New Republic scum!
Anger not entirely her own threads up through her like braiding vines. And as she rolls over, she sees it's not a Republic soldier at all. It's Remy. His face is pale and struck with fury. As he yells at her, spit flecks from his mouth.
You aren't worthy! That's mine! Everything you have been given, I gave you! You weak stripling! You coward! You thief!
Her hand is empty. The lightsaber hilt is gone. She paws at the ground, kicking at him with clumsy feet as he descends upon her. Remy's long-fingered hands find her neck and close around it. He's weeping and laughing as his grip tightens. She gags, trying to get air. Her own hand bats at the wet grass, finding no lightsaber. Above them is the darkness of the outpost landing platform, and she hears the screams and yells of the acolytes and their victims. Someone falls off the edge and lands nearby. Thud. Everything starts to go black. Her eyelids flutter. Then she finds it. Her fingers close around cold metal. It happens fast, but feels slow. She jams the unignited blade against Remy's temple. His eyes are round and suddenly afraid. The red blade spears through his skull. His eyelids strain open. The eyes themselves cook and go red before burning to cinder. He drops. Kaisa stands, adjusting her mask. Then she lets the anger take her anew, and she resumes her assault. Soon, the outpost falls. Soon, the acolytes claim triumph.
Chapter 25. War is coming. Leia sits and tries not to think about it. She doesn't turn on the holonet. She doesn't go to her balcony on Chandrilla and look up in the sky to see the fleet gathering in orbit. Instead, she sits on a chair in the room that will very soon serve as the nursery to her son. The cradle sits nearby. Next to it is the sanctuary tree, the one given to her by the little Ewok, Wicket. She's never been able to feel the tree, the so-called serpent's puzzle with the Force, but she can see with her eyes that the burnished golden bark shines with health, and every day the twining branches sport new scarlet leaves. But her baby boy, him, she can effortlessly feel inside her. Not just the way that all mothers can feel the living creature within, but she can feel him. With the invisible hands of the Force. With it, she senses the margins of his burgeoning mind. She knows his mood. She can tell that he's healthy. He is less a human-shaped thing and more a pulsing, living band of light. Light that sometimes dims, that sometimes is thrust through with a vein of darkness. She tells herself that it's normal. Luke said to her, Leia, we all have that. He explained that the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. Right now, her son is upset, tumbling inside her as if he can't get comfortable. His light flickering with the dark. She centers herself and concentrates. The walls of the room fall away. Everything is white, and then it's black. Then she's in the calm, airless void. As Leia finds her peace, so does her son. He stops turning. Then he gets the hiccups. She sighs, and it brings her out of it. But she laughs, too, because the hiccups tickle her. They're like little bubbles inside, a curious effervescence, like nothing Leia has ever felt before.
My son is alive. The future is bright.
That bright future casts dark shadows, though. And now war is again on the horizon. Not a new war, no. The same war they've been fighting all this time. A war that began as a rebellion, and soon transformed into a proper struggle between the Empire and the Republic. Now, she hopes, this will finish it. The future is bright, yes, but only if this goes well. Only if the Empire burns out in a searing flash, gone to ash. Han comes home not long after, and he finds her there in the room. He tells her only a little about what happened on Nakadia, but it's enough for her to know that he had a hand in making things right.
That's what you're good at, she tells him, reaching up to meet him as he stoops down. Making things right.
She kisses his cheek. He looks, aw, shucks, embarrassed.
It's happening, he says. Jakku.
I know.
It's gonna be one hell of a battle. It might get bad.
I know that, too.
He chews his lip.
It feels weird, doesn't it?
Not being there, you mean?
Yeah. You, me, Luke, Chewie, the Falcon, those two walking, talking garbage cans. It feels weird we're not part of it.
We've got our own adventure.
She pats her belly.
End of an era, he says.
And the start of a new one.
The baby turns inside her again, troubled by something she cannot feel and cannot yet understand.
War is coming. And hopefully, soon after, it ends. Sinjir cares little for the vagaries of war. He tells himself he has no investment in whether the New Republic wins or loses, even as he feels himself looking forward to the demise of the Empire he once served. Rather, he needs the war, because that is the only way he fears he'll ever get to see Jazz and Nora again.
Ow! Condor says, wincing. You're not paying attention to what you're doing again.
I'm paying attention perfectly, Sinjir says, screwing a small plug of absorbent fiber cloth into Condor's nose.
The slicer winces and pulls away.
Your mind is wandering like a child at a toy market.
Sinjir shrugs.
Fine, yes, perhaps. Sorry. I'm more used to causing pain than soothing it.
He winds another bit of cloth into the other nostril.
The two of them are back on Chandrila.
Solo brought them home. They toyed with staying on Nakadia for a time, but Condor frowned at the notion, saying that the pastoral planet made Chandrila look like Coruscant.
It's all just crops, he said at the time,
and Sinjir was inclined to agree. Now Sinjir works to mend the slicer's abused face, back to gauze, fiber cloth, and a good old-fashioned needle and thread. The worst hit was the last one Condor took, the one they heard over the comlink.
I must commend you again, Sinjir says. A transceiver tooth? Genius. And I never knew.
That's how Condor broadcast to them, using his tongue to slowly, arduously flip to their comlink channel.
The broadcast ended when that Herglick thug whapped him in the face. A man must keep his secrets.
Not me. I have none. I am done with secrets.
Somehow I doubt that, Sin.
Condor's gentle eyes twinkle. Sinjir admires the man. His drive, his capability. After rescuing the slicer from the warehouse, they had to move fast. The good news was, as suspected, that the Black Sun and Red Key thugs had hacked a line to the data pads of their five senators. The line was encrypted, though, which is where Condor came in. The slicer did as the name suggested,
slicing through algorithms like a man with a blade cutting ribbons. In only a few minutes, Condor, beaten, woozy, caked in his own blood, stole access to the senator's datapads. And from there, they delivered the messages. Sinjir's initial idea was to threaten them, but Sinjir also knew that threats created fear, and fear made people act a certain way. It's one thing to have someone bound to a chair. There, you control the fear. You wield it like a weapon. But those senators were in the wind. A fight-or-flight response could have had them doing any number of unpredictable things. Turning themselves in, running for the exits, or even voting as the syndicates demanded they vote in the hope it would save them. No. Instead, Sinjir said to make them an offer. An offer braided into the threat. He had Condor send a missive telling them they would be given pardons if they voted with the Chancellor. And further, they told Nimtar that his child was safe, and Sorka that her prize Jerba was rescued. That latter bit was a necessary lie. Sorka will soon learn that the syndicates already sold her prize animal on the butcher's black market. And with that, they did it. They solved the plot. They got the votes. The final battle is coming. Condor says,
"You're worried."
"Am I that obvious?"
"Usually not. This time you are."
Condor clasps his hand.
"Jazz and Nora will be fine."
"I could go. I should go. Demand to be put in a ship. Like Jom. Like Temin. I should be there."
"You're not a soldier."
"I trained to be once," Sinjir says. "I know how to fight."
"If you want to go, I'll go too. Maybe they can use a slicer."
Sinjir nods. "I suppose it's not impossible." He hates that he wants to be there. He knows himself, and he should be balking at this. Loyalty only goes so far. And despite once being the man who tested the loyalty of others, he himself is not particularly fond of the concept. And yet, here he is, wanting to rush into danger again for his friends. He supposes he should stop being surprised. "I've become a different person than I expected." Or maybe he was a different person all along, led to a myth about himself, created by himself. Is that how people are? Do they all have two sides? Who they really are and who they believe themselves to be?
Who do we ask?
Considering the size of the favor we just performed in service to the Chancellor, I think we might ask her. Condor draws a deep breath.
"Are we going to Jakku? Are we really doing this?"
"We might be, dearest Condor. We might be."
"I'd hoped for a nicer vacation."
Sinjir hums. "You and me both."
War is coming. It's what Jom Burrell is built for. He never really felt like he trained for war, but rather that he was just plain made that way. All his life it's been about the fight. He fought against the Empire on Onderon. He fought against his own bloodline brothers there. He fought as a rebel. He fought as a commando for the New Republic. He fought with Nora and her crew. And now he wants to fight again. Sergeant Dalalo Dacen is, with her Spec Force team, loading munitions onto a low Atmo U-Wing. It's a fat-bellied starfighter, used as a troop transport, meant for fast, dangerous insertion into enemy territory. It's an old class of fighter, but this is an old class of soldier. Jom feels that way too. He whistles to Dacen as he skirts past one of the ship's four engines.
"Sergeant,"
he calls. She turns and stares down her long nose at him.
"You cleaned up,"
she says. And he has. He shaved everything down, though he left the handlebar mustache and the meat chop sideburns. He combed his hair, best he can do to look like a proper commando again.
"What do you need, Burrell?"
I need to go with you.
No can do. Not my call. You want back in? There's a whole chain of command you gotta climb.
She sees his face and offers both hands up in a peaceable gesture.
Don't get mad at me, John. You broke ranks and did your own thing. You go and talk to General Tybin. Maybe he gives you a stamp and gets you back on your way. But it won't be with my crew.
Damn it, Dason.
Sergeant Dason, if you recall.
His nostrils flare.
Sergeant, this fight, it matters. Maybe more than all the others.
She probably thinks he means it because this could be the Empire's last hurrah. And that's true. But for John, it's personal. For John, it's about Jazz. He drops his back. He cranes his neck so that the vertebrae pop.
I'll fight you for it. I'll fight the whole platoon for it. I take even one of you out, I want to take that commando's place.
Dason laughs.
We'd kill you.
Maybe, but that's better than having to go through the bureaucracy.
Coming off the ramp, pushing an empty grav lifter, is another Spec Force commando. A goat-snouted, three-eyed Gran, by the name of Margal. Jom knows him a little. He's like Jom, good with heavy ordnance.
I hear something about a fight,
the Gran growls.
I'm in.
Cool it, Dason says. Nobody's throwing fists today. And you're right about the bureaucracy. You start making noise here, I might have reports to do. And damn the stars, I hate filling out reports.
Dason. Sergeant.
Stow it, John. You want in on this mission? Fine. I got an extra jump seat. You want to do your part? I'll say you came aboard and hidden ahead until we were pushing hyperspace. But after that, I won't stand for you. You come home, they might have a court-martial or a dishonor badge for you. That weights on your shoulders. And I won't carry it.
Thanks, Sarge.
We leave in 5. Step to it, Commando. The war won't wait.
War is coming. And Temin wants to be there. He steps in front of Wedge and drops his hastily packed rucksack on the ground with a thud. Wedge looks at it and arches an eyebrow.
What's this?
He asks the young man.
I'm enlisting.
It doesn't work like that, Tim.
I don't care. I want to go to Jakku.
You're a boy.
Not anymore. You were training me to be with Phantom Squadron. I can fly an X-Wing.
Wedge sets down his datapad. All around him, the hangar buzzes with activity. Already most of the starfighters and their pilots have gone on to join the fleet, massing above Chandrila, soon to fly on to Jakku. But all the same, that's just the first wave. They have to prep more fighters, more pilots, prime torpedoes, test weapons systems, get the next set of pilots ready. There's a lot to do, and he tells Temin as much.
You can fly a training simulator, kid. I've got work to do.
I've piloted the Halo. I've piloted the Falcon. You even let me do a few rounds in an X-Wing. I can fight, and I will. I'll steal a ship if I have to. I'll steal a flying brick cargo loader and crash it into the front deck of a Star Destroyer. I'm going to Jakku. And I'd rather you be there with me.
Phantom Squadron is shut down.
Temin steps over his sack and looks up at Wedge. The young man's eyes flare with eager fury.
Then bring it back from the dead. Nobody has to know we're doing it. Nobody has to see us coming. We can be like real phantoms, Wedge. Not heroes in the books. But who cares about being in the books?
Now tears shine in Temin's eyes.
My mom is there. My droid, too. I want them back.
You don't want to help me get them? Fine. But then I'll know who you really are.
And it isn't the guy who flew against 2 Death Stars and all the Empire. I'll know you're not a pilot anymore. You're just some hangar monkey.
some tired old Sir Yes Sir game leg who cares more about docking ledgers than he does about actual people.
Now it's Wedge's turn. Anger and grief rise up inside him. The anger like fire, the grief like smoke. He wants to tell Temin how wrong he is, but he can't. Because the kid isn't wrong, is he? Again, Wedge is reminded of the Rebel Alliance, and Kashyyyk, and all the sacrifices made on behalf of the New Republic. Sometimes doing the right thing wasn't the same as following orders.
Ah, forget it,
Temin says, wiping his eyes with the back of his hands. His lip trembles.
I should have known you were out of the game.
Wait.
Temin pauses in picking up his bag.
Why should I?
Meet me in Hangar 47 on the north side in 2 hours.
What's in Hangar 47?
Phantom Squadron.
War is coming. It waits out there in the black. Commodore Kirsta Augate stands on the bridge of the Concorde, the first Nadiri Mark I Starhawk commissioned for the New Republic, and not the last. Two more Starhawks hang out there in the space above Chandrilla. They wait with dozens of other capital ships. The Alderaanian Sunspire, the Corellian Redeemer, an assault frigate, and of course, their flagship, the Mon Calamari's Home One. Her hands are shaking. As they do. In the glass of the viewport, though, is a ghost hovering amid the fleet. A ghost with a ruined face. Half the face is smooth and plasticky, fitting poorly against the other, more natural half. That plastic has none of the blemishes associated with flesh. No moles, no marks, no crow's feet by the eyes, no curving lines carved around the side of the mouth. It is an imperfect fit as well. Around the eye, the skin ends prematurely, yielding the dark turning mechanics that support the mechanical eye. That eye glows red. It telescopes as the aperture opens, and it focuses on its own reflection. For the face of the Wraith is just Augate's own mask. On Liberation Day, one of the Rhodian ex-captives turned on her, driven to the act by a control chip in the meat of his brain. He fired, and she took the hit on the side of her face. They reconstructed the bone, but the flesh was gone. What's there now is new skin, grown in a lab and applied with a brush. Over time, it is meant to look more natural, but it'll never be her own. Augate will always know. The eye had to go. She asked for a mechanical replacement. The Oculus lens that they installed at least has function, if not form. It is ugly and protrusive, and makes her feel less than human. But with it, she can see heat signatures and other data as long as she closes her other human eye.
Commodore!
Behind her, Admiral Akbar steps out of the turbolift. It shushes closed behind him. Akbar has been a friend through all of this. A comforting presence at her bedside and through all the surgeries.
I never thought I'd be back,
she says. Her voice is different since the attack. The blast took out some of her teeth, messed up her jaw. It's all been reconstructed, but now she sounds different. She hates it.
I'm glad you accepted the invitation.
She turns. The Mon Calamari approaches, his hands clasped behind his back. As he walks, she tells him,
It means a great deal to me, Admiral, but I still have reservations. I don't know that I'm ready.
You are. You must be. Commodore, you are among our best and our brightest.
Some of the light has gone out of me, Admiral.
And despite what happened, you remain one of our most vital commanders, because you recognize the burden of war. You do not go to it lightly. You do not arrive with anger, not even after the Empire struck us at home and stole your eye from you.
I gave up command of this ship.
And I have returned it to you. Lieutenant Commander Spawn is glad to serve at your behest.
I'm not ready.
Akbar's voice softens. He reaches out and places one of his webbed hands on her shoulder.
None of us are ready.